That's the Flat Mountain Girls performing their special brand of Appalachian folk music. One of the very best things about Appalachia, it's traditional music. There's plenty more good in Appalachia, a swath of which includes the southeastern portion of the Buckeye State. And there's plenty of struggle with poverty, isolation, and in recent years, the scourge of the illicit prescription drug trade. Most of Ohio's poor live in the major cities, but 10 southern Ohio counties near the Ohio River border with Kentucky and West Virginia, where things are no better, have great percentages of people eligible for public assistance. Joining us now to talk about how she incorporated the good, the bad, and the ugly in her debut novel, A Killing in the Hills, is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and West Virginia native, Julia Keller. You might recall Julia from her days at the Dispatch. These days, she is the cultural critic at the Chicago Tribune, and she also writes the weekly Lit Life column that runs in the arts and entertainment section there. Welcome to the show, Julia Keller.
Oh, hi, Anne. Nice to be here.
I imagine you've wanted to write a novel about Appalachia and your beautiful home state of West Virginia for a long time. Was the issue of the illicit prescription drug trade the trigger for you?
You know, it was indeed. I grew up in Huntington, West Virginia, and my father taught at Marshall University there. So all of my early memories and adolescent memories, of course, are West Virginia. And I had this idea in my head, of course, you know, I wanted to be a writer, and like all of us who dream of that thing, that I would write a novel about a, you know, young girl growing up in West Virginia, goes away and makes her fortune and fame in the big city. Along the way, and I worked at the Columbus Dispatch and then now the Chicago Tribune. But I have to say, I never quite found the story I wanted to tell. Somehow, a strictly autobiographical story seemed kind of tedious to me. Having lived it, I didn't want to then write it. But a couple of years ago, I came across a series in the Los Angeles Times. And to my amazement and surprise and dismay, the dateline of the very first installment was Huntington, West Virginia, my hometown. It was a series about drug abuse and the illegal drug trade in Appalachia. I was just stunned. I read the story, then called some friends of mine still back in West Virginia and said, can it be? Is it really this bad? And to a person, they said, worse. So at this point, I had a decision to make whether to write it as a nonfiction series. I mean, the Tribune is a great forum for writing a really intricate, long series. We do a wonderful job with them. And I've always been attracted to the nonfiction form. But something just told me, kind of nibbled at the edges of my consciousness, that this really needed to be fiction. I've always felt that fiction is the genre where we really, really can get in touch with the reality of life, the visceral feeling of life, much more so than nonfiction can. Nonfiction, we're kind of chained to fact. And as dramatic as those kinds of stories can be, they still just don't have the power that we think of. When we think of the Great Depression, we think of the great novels of the Depression. We think of the Grapes of Wrath, I think, far sooner than we think of some of the great journalism that was done at the time.
Yeah, because in journalism, it's going to be ultimately filtered through your sources as well, who have, no matter what, insecurities and self-consciousness.
You know, that's a great point. I think, too, journalism does become a forum for proclamation many times. Now, they can be wonderful proclamations. They can be great rhetorical flourishes. But ultimately, people know they're talking for publication. Whereas when you are writing fiction, you are channeling the real-life lived experiences of people, the joys and the sorrows and the darkness and the light. And it's not a proclamation-based form. It's a living form.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Julia Keller. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, but she's also the author of a new novel, her first. It's called A Killing in the Hills. It's a mystery that takes place in West Virginia, her home state. We are talking about, for this hour, the juxtaposition of the poverty and the illicit prescription drug trade in Appalachia, the problems it's caused. And later on, we're going to talk to a couple of the people who are trying to solve some of those problems. If you have a question or comment for Julia right now, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to the Facebook page. You can also tweet us at WOSU All Sides. Loved the book.
Oh, thank you.
You can't always say that.
That's true. And I know you're sincere because I can't. Yes, I have to believe
in
you.
In fact, I'm kind of ticked at myself because I read it as soon as I received it, I think 3 weeks ago. And then last night when I was preparing, I'm like, oh, gosh, I got to go back.
But, you know, that's a good point. If something is readable, I have to say, you know, I'm a longtime literary critic past, you know, 10, 15 years. And while I love what's called literary fiction, you have to imagine air quotes there around literary fiction. I do love it. I so admire a fiction that is kind of difficult and profound and all of that. The reason I chose a mystery for this story was I wanted it to be readable. I mean, there's no higher compliment to me is when somebody says, I stayed up till 2:30 last night to finish it, even though I had to go to work the next morning, or it kept me captivated. Now, they might have been captivated just by the whodunit factor, and that's fine with me. I mean, the very first duty is to entertain, to me. It can't be a kind of an eat-your-spinach thing. You've got to have people entertained and captivated.
Were you torn, though, even though the drug problem is what triggered the idea for the story and gave kind of like a parameter to the story for you, were you torn about delving so deeply into the muck of the problem?
You know, I really was. I'm always so conscious of West Virginia's reputation, and to do anything that would sully that reputation further. I mean, coming from West Virginia, you're used to the jokes. You're used to it. My first couple of days in Chicago, people would hear us from West Virginia, and colleagues at the Tribune would come up and say, you're from West Virginia? And I would say, yes. And this one fellow said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, I'm pretty sure. And he kind of shook his head, and he said, well, all I got to say is you're doing wonders for the reputation of that state. Which, as I pointed out to him, was really not a compliment. I mean, there was embedded in
it's
that.
It's a backhanded compliment.
Yeah, very backhanded. And you're used to it, and you get the jokes all the time. And so I thought to write something that is not wholly positive felt a little bit like piling on. And so I was very conscious of that. And yet, this problem is so endemic to West Virginia now, so entrenched now, and is transforming the state in ways that we've heretofore never seen. I mean, the state has its problems, of course, poverty, absentee land ownership. The news came out just yesterday that a major coal company is going to be cutting a substantial number of jobs there, which is just going to further the terrible problems there. Lack of education, lack of opportunity for education, all these things. So I thought, here I come along and add one more thing. But again, I think fiction's power to be the prism through which we look at these difficult problems, look at the struggles people have in their lives, is really unsurpassed. And to me, I really did think of it, and as I'm sure John Steinbeck did The Grapes of Wrath. I mean, to compare myself with that's a little ridiculous. But I think the motivation is the same, that you want to show that these are good people, well-meaning people that get trapped in something far beyond their control. And then what do they do? And what is our responsibility as citizens of this country to help with this terrible problem?
You're often in the book juxtaposing the beauty with the isolation,
mm-hmm.
particularly the isolation, that sense. And to what extent does that isolation contribute to the problem?
Oh, you know, I think it's just immense, Anne. I was down in West Virginia last fall, standing in line waiting to board a train. They have a wonderful train that goes to the New River Gorge. And of course, stunning physical beauty, just where your whole soul leaps up in response to it. And a fellow in front of me was telling about his youth in a coal town that no longer exists. You know, when the coal company goes out of business, the town's gone. I mean, imagine your hometown no longer existing. In any case, I heard him say, well, where I grew up, the only way out is up. And I thought, what a marvelous phrase, and one that just completely powerfully encapsulates the feeling of being so isolated, where you feel to do anything in your life, to make any kind of mark, you have to get out, this notion of getting out. And my character, Belle Elkins, of course, comes back. She comes back deliberately and purposefully to try to help this problem. So that's always the question.
And the thing is, your protagonist, Belle, she's the local prosecuting attorney. She grew up there, though, under the worst possible conditions.
Yes,
and she still went back.
Still went back, despite all of that. And I so admire the people that know the worst of a place. I mean, I think she has a line in there when she says, we know the worst and most horrific parts of a place, and yet still come back and stick around and knowing they can do some good incrementally, slowly, gradually, but some good nonetheless.
And then yet the ones that are doing the bad guys aren't necessarily outsiders.
Exactly. That's another problem. Actually, Jack, your guest in your next segment and I were discussing just a moment ago. That's exactly right. Often your friends and neighbors ended up being the very people who are involved in the illegal prescription drug trade. Again, it's a unique kind of a problem. It's one we haven't seen before. This isn't heroin, cocaine, all these problems we're used to seeing. This isn't meth labs. That was a big problem I had in telling people about the novel, particularly friends in Chicago.
They assumed it was the meth
labs. Amphetamine. Always meth, meth, meth. You know, in fact, in book two, which is going to come out next year, The Further Adventures of Belle, that's what she keeps saying. She's complaining. And she says, as a prosecutor, she goes to these conventions of prosecuting attorneys. They all say, oh, right, we know about the meth labs. You know, we've seen Winter's Bone. We've seen Justified, the great cable show. And she keeps saying, we're not talking about meth labs. She says, meth labs I can handle. I know who's running those. Those are the scums and the lowlife and the people we've known for a long time who are the criminal element. That's not this problem. This is different. this are the people who look like you, who are struggling, who are hardworking, who often have to fund their own prescription drug habit, which came about through perfectly legitimate ways. But here they are now. They need the money. They are desperately addicted, and so they, too, have to turn to crime.
I was wondering if you'd read a section from the book that I think does a great job of juxtaposing the beauty, the isolation, the good and the bad and the ugly, all in one. And it's a description of Acker's Gap, the place we're talking about.
Yes, I'm glad you said Acker's, by the way. I just heard the audio book, the recording just came out.
Ouch.
And the woman says Acker's Gap.
Oh, no.
They had to scrape me off the ceiling. I think they're going to change it in the subsequent mailings, but I was like screaming, you know, to the air. In any case, so it is indeed Acker's Gap. Fictional, but I think it should ring true to those who've been to the area. It was a shabby afterthought of a town, tucked in the notch between two peaks of the Appalachian Mountains, like the last letter stuck in a mail slot after the post office has closed down for keeps. Acker's Gap was situated within sight of the Bitter River, just over the ridge from the CSX railroad tracks. It consisted of a half dozen dusty, slanting downtown streets surrounded by several neighborhoods of older homes, two trailer parks, a tannery, a junkyard specializing in domestic auto parts, and a shut-down shoe factory ringed by a blacktop parking lot against which the weeds and the wadded-up Doritos bags and the crushed camel packs were staging a hostile takeover. The county courthouse, built under a massive, rocky outcropping that left a good portion of the town in shadow except at high noon, was stone-wrapped, high-windowed, fronted by a wide sweep of gray concrete steps and four white pillars, and capped by a theoretically gold dome that had silently begged for a new paint job since about 1967. Just outside the city limits was a handful of played-out coal mines, and beyond and above them, the corrugated foothills of the Appalachians, their sides dense with sweet birch trees and scarlet oaks, the ground crowded with mountain laurel and black huckleberry. It was a beautiful place, especially in the late spring and throughout the long summer, when the hawks wrote slow, wordless stories across the pale blue parchment of the sky, when the tree-lined valleys exploded in a green so vivid and yet so predictable that it was like a hallelujah shout at a tent revival. You always knew it was coming, but it could still knock you clean off your feet. It was also an ugly place, a place riddled with violence, the special kind of violence that follows poverty the way a mean dog slinks along behind its master, a thoughtless, automatic, knee-jerk violence, a what-the-hell kind of violence that was, Bell had often heard the sheriff say, nearly impossible to stop.
That's Julia Keller. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and also an author. She was just reading from her debut novel. It's a mystery. It's called A Killing in the Hills. We'll return to our conversation with Julia and more when in just a few minutes. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm General Manager Tom Ryland, congratulating the WSU News Team for being named the best radio news operation in Ohio, including Steve Brown for Best Anchor, Sam Hendren for Best Editor, and Mandy Trimble for her investigative reporting. Hear more from our news team on 89.7 NPR News and online at WOSU.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News, 58 degrees, sunshine warming up to a high of 67 today. Clear skies tonight, a low of 46, sunshine and a high of 75 on Thursday. Support for 89.7 comes from Mauburn Academy, a forward-thinking school for ADHD and dyslexic students, hosting a community parent seminar, How High School Designed Specifically for ADHD Students Can Make All the Difference, Monday, September 24th at 7 p.m. More information at marburnacademy.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Where drugs and poverty intersect in Appalachia is not a pretty place, despite the grand folk music and the natural beauty of the region, a large swath of which sweeps into Ohio. What's the problem and what are the solutions? Still with us is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Julia Keller, whose debut novel, A Killing in the Hills, is about the violent intersection of poverty and the illicit prescription drug trade in Appalachia. Julia, once again, thanks for joining us today.
So happy to be here.
Joining us by phone now is Ed Hughes. He's the executive director of the Counseling Center, Inc. It's in Scioto County since 1989, when the center was a small outpatient program employing six staff. Since then, the Counseling Center has grown into a multi-county program employing 175 staff with offices in Adams and Scioto counties in Ohio. Ed Hughes, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Also with us in the studio, Jack Freck. He's the director of the Athens County Department of Job and Family Services for the past 30 years. To date, he has over 39 years' experience in the social service field. He has served as a caseworker, social worker, and administrator. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk about the problem first. I read in the New York Times that nearly 1 in 10 babies born last year in Scioto County tested positive for drugs. Ed Hughes, when did the explosion of prescription drug abuse occur in your area? When did it start to emerge?
Well, what we've discovered in retrospect is that we were essentially the epicenter of the prescription opiate problem. And our tri-state area here in southern Ohio, eastern Kentucky, and most of West Virginia. And around 2000, 1999-2000, is when we started noticing that the number of people coming to our services that were addicted to prescription drugs was increasing from a very small number, less than 5%. And then over the next years, we are at a stage now where 85% of our admissions are people who are addicted to opiates.
You know, prescription drugs have been around forever. Why now or why then? They've been growing pot down in Appalachia for a long time. Drugs aren't new to the area. What was it about prescription drugs that took off the way it did?
Well, it really related to a specific drug, oxycodone. And what we saw with that particular drug is highly addictive. It was aggressively marketed to certain areas of the country, of which we were one. And then once people started becoming addicted and we started seeing a number of people seeking the drug, either through their primary care doctors or emergency rooms, then we saw the proliferation of what we refer to as pill mills, which were they called themselves pain clinics, but with the express purpose of essentially making this drug OxyContin available to the people in our community. And then it became beyond our community. We had 10 pill mills operating just in Scioto County. Scioto County is a population of about 84,000 people, and in 2010. We had over almost 10 million doses of prescription painkillers prescribed in our county, which came out to about 123 doses per person in our community. And of course, not very many people were actually getting those, so it meant that they were going in large quantities to a few people or people who were coming from outside our area into our community to acquire the drug.
What's the difference, in your opinion, from the treatment point of view? Why is it just that these are so incredibly addictive? Because so is methamphetamines.
Yeah, it's incredibly addictive, and it moved within our community. It started within our community very differently than what most drugs would. If they can't, methamphetamine would come to our community, it would hit a certain segment of our community, perhaps people who were more poor. There were a lot of folks that would not experiment with methamphetamine just from a cultural or an attitude basis. But the prescription opiates actually started within our community with middle and upper income young adults, primarily white, almost exclusively white, and more women than men. So it entered our community very differently, was used very differently, and so what we found was that we have a very addictive drug that is working its way through every strata of the community, not isolated to certain pockets of our community, and then, of course, finding its way, into the hands of people through, either pill mills, people seeking the drug, buying it off the street, becoming drug dealers themselves, and then transitioning eventually is what we're seeing now to heroin.
You know, when you describe it starting up at the upper and middle class, it makes so much sense then because those folks have the resources to hide the problem for a longer period of time.
Yes, or if they were buying it off the street, these drugs were very expensive. So we were talking about generally a dollar a milligram on the street. And so we're talking the most drug-addicted people to OxyContin were using 60 to 100 milligrams a day. So, you know, it was not an easy drug for the poor to, you know, to use. Now, eventually, it made its way down to where kind of within our underground economy. And Appalachia in particular, where you have generational poverty, you will find an underground economy, people who are figuring out ways to try and make money to support themselves. And so the sale of this drug was so attractive because you could get a prescription written to you by a doctor, maybe purchase the medication at the pharmacy with Medicaid or Medicare, and then sell the drug on the bottle of drugs on the street for maybe $2,000 to $3,000.
You know, the poverty is an interesting aspect of that because I've read stories about elderly people who really do need the painkiller of whatever stripe it might be, but are so poor they're selling it.
Yes. And then what was discovered, of course, is that there was such a market for the drug that, you know, people who would not be your traditional drug dealers became your drug dealer in the community. It was people who could get access to the drug mm-hmm. because they had a health issue that would allow them access to that prescription. But then when the pill mills came in, they were giving the drug to anybody that walked in the door. So, you didn't have to have a legitimate health issue to be able to get a prescription for OxyContin at that point.
You know, talking about the underground economy and how poor people are going to get the money for these kinds of drugs, Jack Freck, I mean, it seems like they're trying to, you know, squeeze blood from a turnip.
Well, that's true. I think, though, what, you talk about that time period.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that happened during that time, people, is that poor people got more poor. And there were more and more poor families out there who had no cash income whatsoever. But a large portion of them were eligible for Medicaid. And so as time went on, you know, this whole idea of a black market got to be more and more essential to these families, as they literally, even the folks who were getting assistance, didn't have enough cash to pay their bills. A typical family on welfare might only get, $300 or $400 a month. They literally just couldn't even cover all their bills. But if they or someone in their family had access through Medicaid, and of course, pain pills are generally accepted in society as a good thing. You know, as opposed to meth. I mean, it was just like that. That's okay. And so I think, there are a variety of reasons. A lot of these folks were poor because they did have physical health problems that required that they take pain pills. Some of these folks, again, some of the families we've dealt with were involved in selling these drugs who don't even actually use them themselves. But because of their need for this cash and they're almost forced to deal with the black market on so many things. They come into contact with these same folks. That has exacerbated this problem by the fact that so many of these folks don't have sufficient amount of money to live on in the first place. And again, more and more of them are working low-wage jobs. A lot of them, don't have they may not have health insurance benefits, but they may have, again, their children or someone in their family who has Medicaid or Medicare eligibility, and that gives them a payment source to buy these drugs.
Which, as I would say, is a good thing. As Jack and I were discussing, I mean, it's a good thing. These pharmaceuticals are wonderful, wonderful drugs. We now are able to control the pain of end-stage cancer patients, terminally ill. They're wonderful breakthroughs from a pharmaceutical standpoint, and that's what makes this problem, I think, such a terrible, perverse paradox, because on the one hand, it represents the great breakthroughs in our science and technology to have them. But, of course, then what happens is this is the kind of medication you're able to function. The television show House, they show a physician functioning at a very high level while he's addicted to prescription medication. So, and it's an accurate portrayal. You can function as opposed to other kinds of addictions, which you're not able to function in daily life. So there are all kinds of perversities associated with this that I think we're not, as a country, really coming to grips with. No one would want there not to be prescription pain medication. For heaven's sakes, it does great things. But as Jack and Ed suggested, it it disproportionately affects this area of the population where people, I think, would have had a moral repugnance to drug addiction in years past, not just a cultural predilection against it, but a moral, their moral strictures against it in their heart and soul. And yet they become addicted because they were prescribed these drugs by very reputable physicians, thinking they're doing the right thing.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the intersection of poverty and the illicit prescription drug trade in Appalachia with Julia Keller, author of a new book. It's called A Killing in the Hills. And also Ed Hughes, he's director of the Portsmouth Counseling Center, and Jack Freck, director of the Athens County Job and Family Services. You want to join the conversation, we welcome your comments or questions. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ed Hughes, an assistant prosecuting attorney, told the Ironton Tribune, I read this, that drug abuse accounts for as much as 90% of the crimes he prosecutes. To what extent are treatment and the criminal justice system in sync in Appalachia, Ohio now?
I think much more. I mean, there has always been a fairly good link between the criminal justice system in terms of trying to intervene and divert people, but because of the problems that this epidemic has brought on in the last 10 years, we're seeing diversion programs. In Scioto County, we have a drug court that is very active and very effective in trying to divert people who have committed felonies that is related to drug addiction. We operate a Second Chance Center, which is a drug diversion or a program for people who are probably headed to either side, you know, to our jail system or to our prison system. And it's just recognized that we're really dealing with people who are very sick that need to get well versus people who are very bad that need to get good. And as we make that transition, the criminal justice system plays a very important role in being able to help identify that. The problem, of course, that we're dealing with here is that we have, you know, it's an overwhelming problem. The criminality associated with drug addiction is overwhelming. We are now starting to see a new level of criminality because our opiate-addicted prescription painkiller folk are now transitioning to heroin, which is a very different drug, very different in terms of the criminal element, in terms of how it's sold, the violent nature of the drug dealing that goes along with that. And so, you know, we're in another transition phase that has been created because of prescription drug addiction.
It was the, what do you call it, the gateway.
It was what opened up, and Julia mentioned that, you know, that these were folks that have not been attracted to drug use at all. There may have been high alcoholism rates, maybe marijuana, but what we see is that we're seeing this drug, OxyContin in particular, make its way into the youth population in a way that we've never seen with methamphetamine or crack cocaine, and that is a very fast progressing. But if you ask youth, why did you experiment with OxyContin? They say, well, it was prescribed by a doctor. My mother, my grandmother takes it. It's supposed to be safe.
Jack Freck, you've said that a reason so many do not prosper in Appalachia is a structural issue. And I was wondering if that's part of the reason why there's this constant churning of the drug problem there as well, if that structural problem affects that as well.
Well, the very fact that these folks are poor, and the communities are poor. I mean, that's the other thing to keep in mind about this. So as a result, you don't have a treatment center on every corner by far, and I'm sure Ed would echo that. You know, you have the people themselves, when they have addiction issues, you know, they still have daily problems about how to meet their basic needs. So trying to structure some kind of treatment program for people who have serious, serious survival problems every day anyway, you know, makes it almost impossible, you know, to provide adequate treatment for these folks. And then you layer onto that just simple things like transportation. One of the huge problems we have in getting people into treatment is the fact that they can't afford vehicles. You know, there might be one vehicle shared by two or three families. You know, that also involves getting someone to work once in a while. You know, and so the poverty itself makes it more difficult, that even with an ideal treatment program, trying to overcome that makes it harder. So you have this kind of fertile ground out there for expansion of the addiction issue. And there's very little to push back on that because the communities are so poor in Appalachia.
And, you know, Julia, in your book, you did bring up the transportation issue, and you talked about the terrain. The terrain itself is just, you know, unapproachable if you're not prepared for it.
Yeah, it's so true. All this,
it sounds simple, but it's complicated.
The beauty of this landscape, the very beauty that we that it causes us to stop and you know, sort of take a deep breath and just kind of bathe in the radiance of it is also the thing that ends up limiting these lives. And I just think it's such an important issue that your other guests have brought up too, that these are not bad people. We do tend to demonize people that have certain kinds of problems. Now, that's not to say that people aren't responsible for improving their own lives and getting themselves out of this fix. But we do have to recognize that there are these endemic social problems. And I try to have my character, Belle Elkins, a prosecuting attorney, I try to have her be, in a way, I think she's a little too harsh about it. And that's on purpose. I mean, she's a little bit of a, I would say hard ass if it weren't public radio. But she...
Thank you.
She isn't as sympathetic. She needs to talk to your other two guests here today and to hear their view of it, because she's just like, go in there, get rid of it. People, they need to just shape up. Let's get rid of this. And that's not the solution.
And the police or the sheriff, I think it's the sheriff in the story, he or other elements in the story, other people in the story say, you know, can't we just take a break from this? Can't we just let it be? Ed Hughes, do you find that too? Just that, like, well, are we causing more trouble than we're helping?
Well, we experienced different phases of that, you know, here in Scioto County in particular, where we were pushing very hard to make the community aware. And at some point, folks just said, you know, we're kind of exhausted right now. Mm. You know, we have organizations that have formed to support people who have had loved ones that have died of drug overdose deaths. I mean, you mentioned the pregnancies. We currently have 22 women in our residential programs who are pregnant. It's striking a young woman at childbearing age, and so we have pregnancies. We have babies, you know, testing positive in the hospital, going through withdrawal. We have maternity people in the hospital that are just overwhelmed with babies that won't stop crying, and it's going to go on for weeks. And at some point, the community just says, we need to take a breath, and we need to think about, you know, what is the next thing that we're going to do, and enough bad news, we need to refocus. And we've been through two or three stages of that, but I have to say, to our county's credit, they have continued to push forward, whether it's law enforcement, the courts, hospitals, primary care doctors, you know, our own counseling staff that gets overwhelmed by this.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Doug Saunders says the video insulting the Prophet Muhammad that provoked violent protests last week was promoted by a movement that plays on fears that growing Islamic communities in Europe and the U.S. represent a threat to Western values and security. Saunders' new book is called The Myth of the Muslim Tide. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow for the history of the end of slavery and Abraham Lincoln's role in the American Civil War. Join us for that discussion for All Sides tomorrow from 10 until noon on 89.7 NPR News. And sustaining givers are the future of our station. A sustainer gives a fixed amount each month. Visit WOSU.org/sustainer to sign up. And thanks for your support. 60 degrees with sunshine, warming up to 67 today. Clear skies tonight, a low of 46. Mostly sunny on Thursday and a high of 75. Support for 89.7 comes from the Midland Theater, presenting Capital Steps, who began as a group of Senate staffers who set out to satirize their employers, the government. Capital Steps will perform Saturday evening, October 27th, at the historic Midland Theater in Newark. More details and tickets at midlandtheater.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about the intersection of poverty and the illicit prescription drug trade in Appalachia. It's in Ohio. It's across Appalachia. We're talking to Julia Keller. She's the author of a new book. It's a fictional account of the issue. It's called A Killing in the Hills. We're also talking with Jack Freck, director of Athens County Job and Family Services, and Ed Hughes, director of the Portsmouth Counseling Center. If you have a question or comment, join the conversation. We welcome it. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Jim in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Well, thank you very much. My son had a very good friend from Mirfield, and he was a good friend of the family, and their family was friends, and he started using some of those OxyContin and things like that, and it got progressively worse in high school, and he eventually left home, tried to go to a few different colleges, didn't work, ended up living in an apartment downtown somewhere with a whole bunch of other friends, and he lost his ability to pay for OxyContin and those kinds of things, and eventually turned to heroin. And I found this out because I asked my son a couple of years after I'd last seen him, what's he up to? And he said, well, he just couldn't afford what he needed, and he ended up on heroin and because it was cheaper, and they'd lost track of him. We don't know if he's alive. He was thinking of going to California, but nobody really knows. And basically started out on OxyContin and eventually couldn't afford it and ended up on heroin. So, I mean, that's
the classic.
You know, he came from a rich, good family, and he's gone now. So that's all I have to say.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Jim. We appreciate it. Ed Hughes, how addictive, when we talk about addictive, how addictive is OxyContin? What's withdrawal like? I mean, what's the challenge there?
Well, the drug is highly addictive. We're seeing that somewhere, and again, we don't have, you know, we have a very short history with this, so it's, you know, it's very difficult to get a lot of good data together, but we know that, you know, where addiction rates for alcoholism run between 6 to 8%, we're seeing that for the other, some of the other opiate medications that we were more used to, Lorsets, Lortabs, Vicodin, we're seeing addiction rates somewhere maybe around 10 to 12%. With OxyContin, it's appearing to start to edge up, looking like it may be in the neighborhood of 20% of the people who, you know, who experiment with that, whether it's prescribed by a doctor or they buy it off the street, you know, are at risk for, again, developing addiction. It happens very quickly. It's very expensive. It steals all the resources. And then the withdrawal is, you know, from any opiate is very painful, very difficult. The brain, as it has adapted to the presence of this chemical, does not cooperate in the process of trying to get well. The brain is essentially saying, I don't want to experience withdrawal. And so once it starts, then the person is obsessed with, you know, getting the drug so that the pain will go away.
I often read about and have reported about that feeling of being ground down in the region. A Toledo Blade article from May used that phrase in a subhead as well, as a lengthy piece on rural poor of Ohio. And I think Ed and Jack, you were both quoted in it, I think. But
yeah.
To what extent does that feeling of being ground down play a role in this too? Jack, you were talking a little bit about that earlier. It's kind of you can't win for losing.
Well, I mean, they live very desperate lives. I mean, and things, decisions are very short term. I mean, they're looking at, you know, how do I feed myself today? How do I solve my problem today? You know, which tends to make for very short term thinking. But, you know, I want to make one thing very clear about this, because I've been working with poor people for a long time. It's a bad decision. This is always a bad decision. Poor people can't afford bad decisions, any bad decisions, as well as people of means can. And of course, you know, when they make this bad decision, it takes a life that's already full of struggle and just makes it that much worse. You know, I think that folks have a hard time imagining why someone might do that until you see, you know, the options you have before you are. So you don't necessarily have the option of of, you know, going to college and getting a great job. And you don't have the options that other people may see in front of them, especially for young people out there. So, you know, unfortunately, they may be looking at the guy down the road who has a truck that runs because he's selling drugs. And that may seem like a more viable option to them right now than, you know, the other career choices that they really don't even see in front of them.
You know, that's something that I see sometimes that people ask me, well, what would be the answer? And one thing I say is that's why I'm so, of course, we're all in favor of education. But when you talk about educational opportunity, because one of the things that education, and for me it has meant education means reading and being aware of the world, it gives you a sense of another kind of life. It enables your imagination to, I mean, take wings, as it were, and to rise up over those mountains and to see beyond them. It's the only thing that does. Not the speeches of politicians, not any platitudes that you know, all of us.
You're certainly not going to look around and see it.
No, exactly. And the only way you're able to lift up your eyes really is through greater educational opportunity, is giving people a sense of another kind of life. And that's when it gets down to what we can do beyond just, I mean, what Jack and Ed do in terms of just the immediate help. What we as citizens who maybe live elsewhere can do is libraries, public libraries.
If there's one thing, too, that I think it's important, because this is kind of going on right now. A lot of these folks have terrible self-esteem. I mean, you know, they're reminded virtually every day that being poor is virtually a crime in this country, and that it's considered a huge character flaw. So people already have very low expectations of poor people, and they of themselves, because of this attitude we have about poverty as a character flaw. And, you know, this just kind of compounds that.
Of course, or the worst thing is, too, is the opposite, is when we act like being poor is some kind of nobility. I mean, I see politicians sometimes talk about it's the opposite, and that's equally limiting and equally devastating when you're told that, well, you're poor, so that gives you an excuse and that gives you – it's somehow ennobling. Just being poor is a real hassle, and it's annoying, and it doesn't feel very good, and it leads to a lot of other things. It's neither noble nor ignoble.
Generational poverty, as we experience it here in Appalachia, lines up almost directly with drug addiction. And Jack was making reference to it. A person gets up in the morning, you know, in a state of generational poverty, and you're thinking about how to get through that day. And if it may be, how am I going to feed myself, or how am I going to entertain myself, how am I going to avoid boredom? But if you add in drug addiction then becomes, how do I get the drug today? It's not about, will I go to jail tomorrow, or am I going to get arrested, or what am I going to do with my life? It becomes very much a one-day-at-a-time lifestyle, which fits perfectly with drug addiction, especially opiate addiction, which sometimes is focused only, how do I get enough of the drug or enough money to buy the drug today to not go into withdrawal?
Pam from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Pam.
Originally from a small county in Kentucky, and it had been featured on the Diane Sawyer show. I forget if it was one of her shows. The rate of prescription drug use is 53% of those that live in the county are addicted to prescription drug. And relevant to what you were just saying is the generational poor. It's a continued cycle. All there is there are coal mines. You know, and they're recruiting kids and juniors and seniors in high schools to bring them into the coal mines. And then that leads to, you know, just the opportunity to buy the drugs for friends, because these kids are averaging 50, 60,000 a year. And the career only lasts 2 or 3 years because they can't take it anymore because of the health issues related with that. And it is... like you said, the relevancy of generational poor and getting these children, youngsters, educated as quickly as possible. But when the county in and of itself is poor, where can you go from there to help? Because it's something that I would love to go back and into the county, because I've lived in Columbus most of my life. Would love to be able to go down and maybe start educational, like you said, the young. We were talking about getting the libraries opened up and getting these kids educated to see beyond the hills, because they don't see beyond the hills.
Yeah, Pam, you sound a lot like my character in my novel, Belle Elkin. She has that same impulse. I'm so glad to hear you say that there are people out there like you who have been there, who know the problem, who want to go back, who see it not as hopeless, but as something that you feel a real responsibility to returning and making life better.
correct.
And to be able to see this in a bigger healthcare picture, drug addiction is a healthcare problem. And there are a number of healthcare problems. And if you line those all up, you will see that we in Appalachia, or the poor, are typically over-medicated or inappropriately medicated for all healthcare problems, not just relative to prescription drugs that may be addictive. But the disparity in terms of how healthcare problems are addressed with the poor, again, is consistent across all healthcare problems, not just drug addiction. Scioto County ranks 88th out of 88 counties in Ohio in terms of our poor health indices. Mm. So it only makes sense that if you say, well, what about this healthcare problem, drug addiction, we're going to be last there too. So to be able to see this in reference to how do we address poverty and healthcare, you know, is where the real answer is, because we can't treat our diabetic problem if we're not treating our addiction problem. And we're not going to be able to treat our addiction problem if we're not treating our nutritional problem with children. It's all related, and it's all a problem.
Pam, thanks for your call.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Take care. Maria on Facebook asks, what is the relationship between the successful interruption of the marijuana supply and the rise of prescription opiates among middle-class people? First of all, has there been a successful interruption of the marijuana supply?
No.
I haven't heard about that one.
No, I haven't heard about that either.
I know they're trying. But has this, I know you're not law enforcement, Ed, but or Jack Frog, has this usurped the whole marijuana issue? Is this, you know, are they still out there trying to burn the bales of marijuana, or are they trying to focus their limited resources in law enforcement on the prescription drug trade now?
I'm seeing that there's more of a focus on the prescription drug trade, and also the transition that we're seeing into heroin, which now, again, is introducing the out-of-town drug dealer and drug sales into our community once again, just like we experienced with cocaine and crack cocaine. And again, we see alcohol in our region is still king. It doesn't get the publicity, but alcoholism rates are still off the chart in the Appalachian region. It is still the number one cause of automobile accidents and deaths, you know, in automobile and other kinds of accidents, industrial accidents. And marijuana is still very much available. We are a poly-substance abuse community in terms of our drugs of addiction. The prescription opiates, they progress very rapidly. They've caused all kinds of social, economic, health problems, which I think has captured the attention and also the attention of law enforcement.
From EDM Facebook, she writes, how accurate is the fictional depiction of this problem in the FX show Justified?
See, I'm not a big fan of that show. I mean, I love the actors.
I've never seen it.
Well, it's based on an Elmore Leonard novel, and a lot of people like it a lot, and I end up arguing a lot with friends who love it. I think it sort of reinforces the worst stereotypes of the region. The people speak in a very stereotypical kind of Eastern Kentucky way. I'm not a big fan of it. I don't see it as anything that particularly helps as we try to make people understand what's unique and special culturally about the region. So I'll just say that. I start out not liking it very much.
It typically depicts, and again, I'm sure it's for dramatic purposes, that there are big-time drug dealers in OxyContin, you know, that essentially drive the market. The reality is that there's hundreds of small-time drug dealers, and many of them are addicted people themselves.
Right.
They get enough of the medication to be able to use themselves and then, you know, sell the rest and then keep that cycle going. So that would be the main difference that I would see, is that, you know, it is not a problem of just the poor. It is not a problem that's taking place just up in the hollers of our region. You know, it is proliferated through every strata of the community, and the drug dealer is not your traditional drug dealer.
Governor Kasich last year announced $36 million in new spending on the problem, and the Obama administration more than a year ago, right around the same time, announced plans to fight prescription drug addiction nationally. Have either of those efforts played out in your territory, Jack Freck?
I think Ed could speak more to what's gone on with the governor's efforts on prescription drugs, because I think they have done quite a bit in terms of shutting down the mills and those kind of things. I'd have to say on the other side, the poverty situation has only gotten worse.
And that's the structural problem.
That's the structural problem. And under both this governor and this president, the poverty problem has gotten worse. And both of them have done things that have exacerbated it.
Ed Hughes?
In terms of the pill mill and legislation around that, House Bill 93 that was passed unanimously by both houses, the House of Representatives and the Senate in Ohio, and was signed by Governor Kasich, we have gone from 10 pill mills to zero in Scioto County. Again, that doesn't mean that the availability of the drug is necessarily that much less, but it is less because of the absence of those. The funding that we were able to get from Governor Kasich allowed us to open our Second Chance Center, which is on any given day is serving about 40 men that are being diverted from the criminal justice system, and again at a very large savings to our local community from a jail standpoint, and of course from a community problem standpoint. So we have benefited from that funding from the governor's office and being able to start our Second Chance Center, serve a lot of people that we never would have, because these are people that have no other resources to pay for treatment. And so that program, was a direct result of the funding that we received from the governor's office.
In terms of the governor and the president, one of the big issues, of course, is a lot of these folks, particularly young adults, are not eligible for Medicaid, which means they're not eligible for many of the treatment programs that are out there, because disproportionately the state is looking, to have Medicaid fund more and more of those treatment programs. And, that's where this expansion through the Affordable Health Care Act would cover those very people, poor people who are, a large portion of those are single young adults who would then therefore be eligible for Medicaid and treatment programs. That decision is very critical.
And it's still pending.
Let me just add real quickly, though, I do think it is definitely a medical problem. I agree with everything that Ed and Jack have said. However, I would add, there is also personal responsibility. There also are decisions that people make every day. I mean, some people in these regions don't do this. One of the things I try to explore in the novel is why Belle Elkins, who comes out of one background, the same background as other people, doesn't go that route. Some people do make other decisions that I want to be careful not to kind of victimize everybody. I mean, make them victims and to sort of infantilize people as if they're children that we have to go help and rescue. Absolutely, we need all these social services and medical resources and everything. But at the end, it's a decision that every individual makes, rich or poor, black or white, Hispanic or Asian American. We all make that decision, male or female, every single day, what our lives are going to be like. And that's one of the questions I try to look at in the novel. Why do we end up being what we are and how we are? What factors go into that decision? Because in the end, it's in the crucible of each individual heart what we become, whether we become a prosecuting attorney trying to help the problem or a criminal making it worse.
Julia Keller, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Julia Keller, she's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, an author of her debut novel, A Killing in the Hills. There's more to come, I understand. We're looking forward to that. Also, Jack Freck, director of Athens County Job and Family Services. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Ed Hughes, director of the Portsmouth Counseling Center. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.